This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. This program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, a weekly program about working people, the labor movement, and organizing on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Don McIntosh. I'm filling in tonight for Ken Allen, who had a schedule conflict. The first part of tonight's show is about income and wealth. Greater income isn't the same as greater wealth. Just in a few seconds, we'll be talking with Meju Louie, who is Executive Director of United Fair Fair Economy, the Boston-based economic justice organization, and a contributor to a new book, The Color of Wealth. We'll talk with her about how ethnic minorities have made progress on wages but are still centuries behind in wealth. In the second part of the hour, we'll be talking with laborers organizer Ben Nelson about a growing tendency at Portland City Council to take union issues seriously, particularly issues of construction workers. There's some interesting developments going on right now, and union folks expect some possible city ordinances to come out of discussions later this summer. We'll talk with him in the second half of the hour. Also, we'll be joined by a representative of the Service Employees International Union, Local 49, which represents janitors. This Thursday, there is going to be a series of demonstrations around the country. It's declared National Justice for Janitors Day. And we'll be talking with Maggie Long from SEIU Local 49 about that in the last part of the hour. Now I'd like to welcome to Labor Radio Meju Louie. Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Meju Louie joins us from her home in Massachusetts.
That's right.
And it's 9 o'clock there, so thanks for joining us so late.
No problem.
And I gather that you know Ken Allen, who was scheduled to be our host tonight. He's executive director of AFSCME Local, Council 75, the statewide labor organization that represents public employees here.
I was an AFSCME worker for about 15 years and a rank and file local president.
That's what I hear. And now you are executive director of an organization that some of our listeners may know, United for a Fair Economy. What would a fair economy look like?
Well, a fair economy would be one in which workers got their fair share in terms of the owners. I mean, after all, they do all of the work and produce all of the products, and why shouldn't things be shared more equitably?
And, of course, one of the areas of equity that you've been looking at recently is race and ethnicity. The organization United for a Fair Economy is publishing a book recently called The Color of Wealth, the story behind the U.S. racial wealth divide, and you're a contributor to that.
That's right. We've always, at United for a Fair Economy, looked at the growing economic disparity between those at the top and those at the bottom. So we were talking a little bit about income. 40 years ago, a CEO made about 40 times what a worker would make. Now that has grown to over 400 times what a worker makes. So we see this huge disparity that's growing like a cancer in our society. But we notice that no matter what is going on in the economy, there is a persistent gap between people of color and whites. And so we wanted to explain the reasons for that gap because we see as the economy gets tighter and people are feeling squeezed, they're wondering, why is it? And we've in the media and stuff that there's a lot of blaming of people of color going on. They say that you know, there's a bunch of freeloaders who are among us, and our government is spending a lot to keep them afloat, and that's not fair. Our book shows that the opposite is true, that our government, in fact, has subsidized white families, often at the expense of families of color, and that is a lot what accounts for the difference today.
Now, by people of color and families of color, what do you mean?
I mean people of African descent, Native American Indians, Latinos, and Asian Americans, all four of those groups.
Okay. And, you know, one of the strengths of your book, it seems to me, is that it goes into detail, breaks this out. Each of them, of course, you know, groups of people that have very different conditions. Maybe we could start with one that you deal with. There's an extensive chapter in the book, Land Rich and Dirt Poor. This is the look at Native Americans and their difficulty. And actually, you know, maybe let me just jump back. I'm sorry. For listeners, when we're talking about wealth, it's different than income. What's the difference between income and wealth, just to define our terms here?
Sure. Well, most of us want economic security, and income alone won't get us that because income comes in, but it usually goes out unless you're making quite a lot. So when we talk about wealth, we really mean economic security, enough money to tide you over for a rainy day in case you have a medical emergency or you're unemployed for a while. Or you have a parent who needs care, or you want to retire, or you want to pass something along to your children. So all of those things require assets and not just income. And what we find is that it's bad enough in society in general. 38% of white families can't last more than 3 months, without income. But for African American families, that's 79% of them can't last more than 3 months. So we're talking about enough assets to last you 3 months and beyond. We really need a lot more than that to get ahead.
It's a good way to look, I think, at ethnic or racial inequality. In that, you know, to some extent, I think you guys have found maybe that that there has been some progress since the passage of the Civil Rights Act and some greater attention to income inequality. There are some inroads being made for the educated few in each group, and yet they're lagging behind ultimately centuries in some cases because for some of the more affluent white folks that they really have had a chance to pass down their opportunities from generation to generation. Of course, I unfortunately was not one of them and I have had no support from my parents, but nonetheless, I think that there is there are other things too, maybe in economic, social capital, that kind of thing. Should we launch into looking at the situations of each of the groups?
Oh, sure.
I know this wasn't necessarily your chapter, but what I was particularly interested in on the Native Americans, this interesting situation, of course, because to some extent their land is held collectively. And how does that work?
Well, in the Native tradition, land is really not something that can be privately owned. Land, trees, air, water, all of those things are things that the Great Spirit gave us. And in fact, that's really what it says in the Bible as well, that those are things that the Creator provided for all forms of life. But the natives really took that to heart, and they saw that their task was not to make the land do more and more for them right now, but to preserve and steward the land. So stewardship was a big thing for the native people. That totally clashed with the European settlers who came here, who had an idea about private property, that land was really supposed to be broken up into little pieces and given out to individual families and, farmed with monocrops in order to make as much money right now as possible. And I think that in terms of the land, that's one of the biggest transfers of wealth we saw. So as Native people were chased off the land from, first from the south across the Mississippi River, and then as more and more European settlers came, pushed farther and farther west and finally onto reservation land. So all of those Indian wars were going on in the early years of the 1800s. In 1830, there was an Indian Removal Act, and so they were indeed removed by federal troops. And in 1862, we had the Homesteading Act, which sometimes when we are taught history in school, it's like, oh, this wonderful act where people got free land.
Well,
that free land wasn't quite so free. It came at the expense of Native peoples who were pushed off of it.
Right. In case you just joined us, we're talking with Meju Louie, who is the executive director of United for a Fair Economy, the Boston-based organization. We're talking about The Color of Wealth, a new book that they've put out about the story behind the U.S. racial wealth divide.
Yes, and I just wanted to say one more thing. I'd like to tell the story of one of the great oil barons, John Paul Getty, at the beginning of the century. He was one of the first millionaires, and of course people wanted to know his secret, and he said, I have three secrets, and I'm happy to share them with you. The first is you have to work hard, and most people say, well, yeah, I can do that. The second is to rise early, okay? The third was to find oil. Now, that one's a little harder, but he did get it right that luck certainly plays a part. So maybe Don, some of your ancestors just weren't quite so lucky.
No, maybe not, although some of them were quite hardworking.
Yes, I'm sure. But the other thing he didn't say, though, is where did that land come from on which he found the oil? And that land was oil that was granted to him through the federal government, through the Homestead Act and other acts.
And I'm guessing that it was granted to him, he happened to be a particularly maybe lucky white person, but there were other people who probably had no ability to get that those kinds of grants, other groups that you've identified in the book.
The reason they weren't able to get it is that the Homesteading Act really said it was available to people eligible for naturalization. So you could be an immigrant, but you had to be eligible for naturalization. And in 1790, one of the first acts of Congress said that in order to be naturalized, you had to not only be hardworking, to have lived here for 2 years, to be ready to swear loyalty to the Constitution, but you also had to be white. It was explicitly mentioned. So my ancestors, the Chinese, who came around the same time as the Irish for the gold rush, were not allowed to become citizens and were not eligible to partake in the benefits of the Homestead Act. So that's one of the ways we've seen benefit very early on that could accrue over generations. And I just wanted to say that I'm sure your ancestors worked very hard, but when we talk about this sometimes with African Americans, they're very kind of upset because their ancestors worked perhaps harder than anybody and yet were not even allowed to get a wage for it.
Right, right. So with the Homestead Act then, and what you're describing also, is that the Chinese Exclusion Act?
Well, it was actually even before the Exclusion Act, the fact that Asians were not allowed to become citizens. And then later they were not even allowed to come in, so that the Chinese were the first group to be barred from entry, even though this is a land of immigrants and the tired and the poor are supposed to be welcome here, but it really meant the tired and poor from Europe.
Right, right. And I think even some of them were sort of discriminated against at first. You know, maybe they had allegiance to the Pope or they spoke the wrong branch of the Indo-European language or something to that effect. One of the things that your book does is it looks at, and this is, I think, something that, people think about, the various ethnic minorities might have had, 30 or 40 years, supposedly, of legal equality, and yet what's happening? Certain groups haven't fared as well as others. And yet there's no accounting for maybe that for hundreds of years it was U.S. law keeping folks out of those kinds of things you're talking about, the land in the breadbasket these square states that were divided up and given out in little parcels, taken away from one group, the Native Americans, and given to another.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And you're certainly right that there were groups from Europe who were discriminated against. And discrimination has existed probably from the beginning and certainly still exists today. But the difference between what happened to them and to groups of color is that that discrimination was encoded into law for the groups of color, where it, after the second generation for Europeans, usually they were able to overcome that stigma. They lost their accent and then they blended in.
And if they were Irish, actually, they went into public service and joined AFSCME.
Yes.
It's true. They became cops
many, many
and prison guards and whatnot.
I was able to do that too.
Yeah. What's that?
I said many, many years later, I was able to do that too.
Right.
But I have to remember, much as I love the labor movement, that the first unions in California were formed around the demand of keeping out the Chinese from certain industries. So the first union label said, don't buy coolie made cigars, don't buy coolie labor. So certainly the first union people were not really friends of the Chinese.
Right, and in fact, I mean, some of those unions were really modeled on fraternal orders. I mean, it was by definition an exclusionary order. You swore the oath. You know, there was certain strange mysticism going on. We won't need to talk about that. But of course, there was a counterexample. You know, if you get into the ancient history, which we should probably get to the present now. But you know, the Knights of Labor were really ahead of their time in terms of really rejecting those racist exclusionary models of unionism.
Yes, there were some, but many unions had in their constitutions bans on people of color, African Americans, and others joining their unions, and that stayed in effect until the 50s in many cases. So that was one way where we also were farther behind, because if you were a union member, we all know you will benefit from better wages and better working conditions, as well as retirement and health benefits. If you have those things, you have much more security and are able to pass more of what you have saved onto your children than without.
So, you know, maybe if we could walk through some of the different experiences of different groups again, though, I did want to know, you know, for example, like in the Native American context, you know, when we talk about, you know, family wealth, you know, you're talking about individual wealth. So what if they're a member of a tribe and they own, you know, a land or a casino or something to that effect? You know, they may not be able to get a bank loan to build a house, and yet, you know, theoretically they're wealthy.
Well, right now, thank goodness, the Native American people have figured out ways to use American law for the first time to their advantage. That probably has only gone on for the last maybe 20 to 30 years, and maybe in the 1980s it began, because they were buffeted back and forth by changes in U.S. policy. You know, first there was reservation land for the whole tribe. Then at a certain point they chopped it up into little pieces and said that the tribe couldn't own the land, only individuals could own the land, and that led to a checkerboard pattern of the land. Then in the 1930s, the tribes were given a little bit more authority to govern themselves, but then in the 60s, the tribes were disbanded once again, and those rights were taken away. So they've been pushed and pulled over several centuries of time. So as they learned, though, to use the laws, and as more Native people went to law school, they were able to use the laws to get back some of their sovereignty rights. And so that has led to greater wealth among some tribal peoples. But certainly the level of wealth that they have, and as I said before, what they're really looking for is both some sense of security for themselves and for future generations, but also the ability to maintain their own way of life. And that has been quite hard to do, and it's quite a tribute to them that in spite of everything, they still are so firmly in touch with their own culture.
Who's the wealthiest Native American in the United States?
That I don't know.
None spring to mind, though, in terms of you think of your vision of billionaires,
fact,
or millionaires even.
No, not an individual Native American person. We did a survey, actually, of the 10 richest men. And I think Bill Gates is at the top of it. He has about $60 billion now. But even if you look at the 10 wealthiest men and then you look at the 10 wealthiest African Americans, the top African American makes probably has only like a tenth of what there is at the top. So we see inequality even at the top.
Certainly, and although and maybe we can move into this, you know, African Americans, their experience. You know, this is something that Jesse Jackson's been focusing on in recent years: is the idea of getting access to ownership of stocks, bonds, financial instruments for African Americans. Now, of course, you know, maybe something about my own political history makes me a little uncomfortable with that idea, because I'm not sure that the system isn't in fact a way to rob, you know, consumers and the taxpayer and workers above all of some amount of wealth and then distribute it to those who own the company. But nonetheless, if you're going to do that, I suppose, then you might as well do it in an equitable way. What's your view on that?
Well, I think if we're looking at government policy once again, just in the last few years, we've seen tax cuts on capital gains and on investment income, dividend income. And, you know, because it is wealthier whites who have stocks and bonds, and they have the capital stuff to sell. They're the ones who own the baseball teams and the works of art and the racehorses, as well as having savings and businesses and all that kind of stuff. Those tax breaks have actually accrued to those who already have a lot, and yet there isn't really much in our tax code that helps the working people. And we're a country that's supposed to value work, and yet in our tax code right now, we're really rewarding inheritance, and we're rewarding ownership rather than working. so United for a Fair Economy really sees that as something that we need to change, and that would help both people of color, but also low-income whites as well.
Right, in a colorblind way, in fact, changing the tax code.
It would. I mean, the fact that people of color are disproportionately low income and low wealth, they would be particularly helped, but it would be something that helped everyone.
If you made the tax structure more progressive, it would, you know, ultimately, I suppose, benefit the people at the bottom the most and restrain those sort of out-of-control fortunes that we're now seeing.
Right, exactly. And United for a Fair Economy, you know, we've been working a lot to stop the repeal of the estate tax, and we actually had a victory on that last week. It was the Senate voted not to repeal the estate tax. The estate tax is our most progressive tax. It falls only on the top 1% of the population. You have to have $2 million to leave behind, at least, in order to owe that tax, in order for your inheritors to owe that tax. And
what's the percentage of the tax?
Excuse me?
What's the percentage of the tax?
Well, first of all, you get to keep the $2 million, and if it's a couple, you get to keep $4 million, and then after that, it's 46%. So if the family had $10 million, 46% of $6 million is, you know, not quite $3 million. So 4 plus 3, you'd still have about $7 million, and yet we saw all of these very wealthy families, the Waltons, for example, the Gallo wine people, the Mars candy bar people, all lobbying to not have this tax. And I think if we look at this history, we really can see that those who gained the most were the ones who the government helped over the years, and they really need to pay back into the system to show that they are grateful for what they got from being in this country, and in order to create opportunities for others, those tax dollars could be used for programs like the GI Bill post-World War II that really catapulted so many working-class people into the middle class.
Again, if you've just joined us, we're talking with Meju Louie, who is Executive Director of United for a Fair Economy, talking about a new book called The Color of Wealth, The Story Behind the U.S. Racial Wealth Divide. What about Asian Americans? Now, of course, that's sort of a broad term, since they too come from a number of different parts of the world. But they're sort of held up as this example of a very successful group. I'm guessing that they are in fact successful, in the aggregate, if you look at academics and maybe even income. What about wealth?
On all of those measures, Asians are the closest to whites. They are not equal, but they are the closest. Now, it's very interesting with the Asian population. We're a very schizophrenic population. We're bipolar. So there's more of us who are upper middle class, but there are also more of us who are very, very poor. So we don't have much right there in the middle. And part of the reason for that is we see people from India and China that are being recruited for high-tech jobs. So they're enticed here with the promise of a good-paying job. And that actually shows that our own educational system is not doing so well. Bill Gates Sr. talks about how his son was able to recruit the best workers, the best-trained computer technology people when he started Microsoft in the 70s from U.S. Universities. But now the quality of our education has gone down, so he's actually looking elsewhere in the world for those workers. So in any case, Asians are coming in with an education and with a promise of better jobs. At the other end of the spectrum, though, we have people from Laos and Cambodia who come from peasant backgrounds and were persecuted during the wars, got drawn into the Vietnam War. And they are the poorest people in the United States today of any ethnicity. The Hmong are the lowest income and lowest wealth people.
More than Native Americans?
Even more than Native Americans, yes.
No kidding. And of course, although I would say maybe if you're looking at the historical application of unequal government policies, then recent immigrant groups like that might not be the best place to look. But what about like Chinese Americans who've maybe been multi-generations in this country?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that our case is interesting. In my own family, there were four generations of Chinese men who spent significant amount of time here, but because of the exclusions and because of the inability to become a citizen, they were not able to have families or to really make a life for themselves here. So, in fact, we saw a declining Chinese population at the end of the last century. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, we saw a decline after the Exclusion Act.
People were going back, right?
Excuse me?
People were going back.
People were going back, and not very many were able to get in.
It's the untold story of immigration, actually. There's been a constant flow of people back all throughout every group at every time. But, of course,
true.
It's just that, you know, on the whole, there's more people coming.
Well, you know, people go back for different reasons. In the case of the Chinese, they were so unwelcome that they went back. In the case of the Irish right now, they're going back because the economy of Ireland is booming, so it's a different situation. But I would compare the Chinese situation to the Irish because we came at the same time. Both came voluntarily, unlike, you know, African Americans or unlike the native people who were already here, and unlike Latinos, for that matter, who in many cases had lived in parts of the country that used to be Mexico that are now the United States or became the United States. But for the Chinese, we were pretty much voluntary immigrants. But if we had been allowed to become citizens like the Irish, you would see us in the numbers and with the wealth and political standing that the Irish have today. So if you look at it that way, you can see the results of our exclusion.
Of course, there's another group that I think for folks, you know, in our community here, may in some cases is still fresh. On the West Coast, you know, I'm sure you're familiar, you know, Japanese Americans did actually accumulate a certain amount of wealth, businesses, farms, and so forth, which was taken away from them during World War II as they were interned and so forth. How did that affect your look at Asian Americans in terms of their ability to take to accumulate wealth?
Well, I think in many cases we've seen cases where sort of against all bets, against all odds, some of these groups, which weren't given opportunities that were given to white families, still accumulated a lot of wealth, and a lot of it had to do with creating ethnic economies. So the Japanese were very successful and had homes and businesses worth, in the aggregate, worth millions of dollars. But they only had a month to abandon their homes when they were sent off to the internment camp in World War II in 1942, so that they had to sell all of that within a week. So obviously they just went at fire sale prices. Those losses were never recouped. So I think we see in many cases where wealth was gained, that those assets were also taken away. Similarly with the blacks, there was a thriving black community in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is talked about in the book because Rose Brewer, one of the authors, is from Tulsa, and they even had their own black banks and Black Wall Street. But in that case, the white community burned it down, drove them out of town, and there was never any compensation for what they lost. I would say also just during the Depression, both whites and people of color lost jobs and income and property. But after we were coming out of the Depression, the New Deal gave a lot of government loans and aid to people to rebuild their businesses. Most of that money, though, did go to whites just because of the discrimination of the federal government itself. Not very much of that money at all went to rebuild black communities or other ethnic communities.
In fact, and even the programs maybe that may have been available or ways that people would get ahead oftentimes were closed, even if it wasn't, you know, racist in the law itself. Like if you look at the National Labor Relations Act, certain groups of workers were not allowed to unionize, like most workers were allowed to, but including, for example, agriculture workers, which at that time were mostly black workers in the South.
That's right.
What are some? We have just a few minutes left now in our segment. But what are some of the ways in the last 50 years that people might not be aware about that government policy has maybe handicapped some groups more than others?
Well, just really quickly, I mean, the GI Bill was a fabulous way to build a middle class. And unfortunately, though, because of discrimination in the housing market and in real estate and in college, many colleges were white only, that black GIs and Latino GIs were not able to reap the benefits of the GI Bill, even though they had sacrificed just as much as their white brothers in that war.
Could they go to historically black colleges on the GI Bill?
They could, but the historically black colleges were flooded with applicants. They could only take 55% of those who applied because there was just so many people who applied, and unfortunately they couldn't get into the all-white colleges.
So opportunity knocked and the door was closed.
Exactly. But I guess I would say that really the message of our book, though, is one of hope as opposed to one of despair. I think what we're saying is that our country really knows how to build a middle class when it wants to. It knows how to build wealth. It knows how to distribute things in a way that people who didn't have much can rise up. And that really is the American dream. And when we talk about wealth, we're really talking about economic security, and I think that's really what we're all looking for. So what we're advocating is that since we know how to do this, we've done it before, let's use our government today to take some of that money that might be coming in through the estate tax that we've just preserved, and use that money to create new opportunity programs, free education programs for those who get through high school and can't afford the college tuitions these days. We need a lot more of that. We need to look at rebuilding inner cities and rural areas that got left out in previous wealth-building policies of our government.
Major Louis, it's been a pleasure to have you tonight on Labor Radio.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, Don. Thanks so much.
I want to mention, of course, the book, The Color of Wealth, The Story Behind the U.S. Racial Wealth Divide, is available at Powell's Books, which is one of the only union bookstores in the country. You can get that online or go down to one of the stores and take a look at it. So.
And you can also find out more on www.colorofwealth.org or faireconomy.org.
Again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Meju Louis, who's executive director of the justice group, economic justice group in Boston, called United for a Fair Economy. Check them out online also. Now we turn to the second part of tonight's Labor Radio show. We're joined now in the studio by Ben Nelson. Brother Ben Nelson is a union organizer with the Laborers International Union of North America. What's a laborer, Ben?
Well, we do a lot of different things, Don. First of all, thanks for the time tonight. We represent primarily construction workers, building buildings in Portland and streets, bridges, and roads throughout Oregon. Doing a lot of different things, building scaffolding, placing concrete, grade checking, pipe laying, stuff like that. And then we've also got quite a few public sector members as well.
And how much does a union laborer make per hour?
Oh, around $22, $25 an hour plus full family health care and retirement.
Is that a skilled trade?
Yes, it is.
Ben, I invited you because there's something going on at City Hall right now. There's been a number of meetings, just gathering steam, I think, in the last couple months, looking at particularly the Portland Development Commission, which I think a lot of cable listeners, if they're familiar with it, probably a little critical of it. I mean, it's been seen over the years as a large pool of tax cash, actually, that's used to help big development projects, typically that tend to benefit some well-to-do private developers. Of course, there's always a public purpose in mind, but, someone's profiting, and, there hasn't been maybe the transparency or accountability. Unions have been getting involved in actually the last few years with some community groups looking at PDC and looking at cases in which tax dollars are used to do projects and the workers aren't being paid a decent wage. Now, you've been working with the group called Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good, haven't you?
That's correct, yeah. And a lot of folks have been paying attention to the PDC and what they're doing. You're absolutely right. They tend to be very developer-friendly. There's very little transparency or oversight in the work that they do, and it generally benefits some of the wealthier Portlanders or Oregonians. And so we've been looking at that. We've been working with, amongst other folks, the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good, which is a coalition of labor unions, churches, their congregations, and community groups that are working on a variety of different issues. One of those has been the Portland Development Commission and defending good jobs in Portland. The MACG, as it's called, the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good, has what we're working on, what's called a Healthy Communities Campaign. It's got several different components, and one of those is health care for construction workers. And since the PDC's got about $250 million that they're spending in their budget a year, they're doing a lot of construction in Portland. They're involved in a lot of partnerships or themselves building. And it's very important that they're held accountable, and folks that are working on those construction sites with PDC money have the health care and the good wages that we need to provide for folks in Portland.
I want to say a few words about MACG, the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good. It's a fairly distinctive organization. It's theoretically based on the ideas of Saul Alinsky, the famed community organizer from the South of the Yards in Chicago. And the way it works is that organizations, membership organizations, join as a group, and they expect to make a major commitment to working together in this grand coalition. There's an enormous number of local churches, sort of the more progressive churches, Catholic churches and other Protestant denominations, and I think even one or two synagogues that are involved in it, as well as a handful of unions, particularly construction trade unions, and some community groups, including recovering substance abusers, which in some ways I think are some of the heart, emotional heart of the MACG experience, which is about sharing stories. So you guys got together with them a few years ago and took part, and you tried to find areas in which you had a common interest that you could work on together. A couple of them have been looking at meth house restoration and cleanup in poor neighborhoods, looking at building more affordable housing for poor people, and now you're looking at health care for workers. In each case, you're going to a an elected official or someone in power. It might be the PDC or the Portland City Commission, and asking them to do something. Interestingly enough, I noticed that each time they agree, but not on the union part. They agreed, they committed to, for example, PDC, Portland Development Commission, build more affordable housing, but not using workers paid a living wage. They agreed to do the restoration, the meth house cleanup, but not pay the workers a living wage. That was one of the demands, but it was one that was not agreed to. Now, of course, you're going directly at it. You want to see if there's a tax dollar spent that's employing a worker, you want that worker to be able to afford health care for their family. Am I right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I wasn't involved in those that work of the MACG around the affordable housing issue. I was involved around the meth house restoration. We had a piece of that that was intended to require responsible contractors when they're doing that type of work. And that got pushed aside, but we're recommitted to working on that and guaranteeing, mandating that all contractors working with city dollars are responsible. And part of being responsible means providing health care for people and their families. We've got far too many people without that basic health care.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. We're talking with Ben Nelson, who's an organizer with the Laborers International Union of North America.
That's right.
What do you prefer to call you go by Ben?
Yeah, that's correct.
And do you prefer Laborers or Leuna?
Laborers.
Is
fine.
It's a little more nice. It has a nicer sound to it. Sort of like workers, laborers.
Yeah, some folks get a little confused. You tell me with the Laborers Union, and they want to know which union. Well, no, it's the Laborers Union.
Right. How many members here locally?
We've got about 4,500 members in the state of Oregon. Close to 3,000 in the Portland metro area.
I want to do maybe a little very unusual education for our listeners who may not actually be familiar with this context. You know, most people think of a union as something that maybe you go to work at a Fred Meyer and all of a sudden you're a member of the union. Or maybe you're in some awful sweatshop and you're fed up with management and you organize a union and it's the whole shop and so forth. Construction unions don't work that way. Construction unions are usually based on this idea of a hiring hall and getting certain contractors to say, yes, we're going to sign the union agreement and employ only union folks. So it's a very different model. And when that happens, one of the ways that I know that you guys keep members employed on a constant basis is that there are laws, federal and state laws, that require government to pay what's called the prevailing wage. This is at the core of what you guys are taking to City Council now and also what you've been asking now for almost 4 years of the Portland Development Commission. You want them to commit to basically obeying state law. If there's a construction project, it can't be driving wages down by paying by taking a low bid that maybe an unscrupulous contractor may, for example, pay under the area standard wages.
Right. The prevailing wage is designed, at least in part, to guarantee that public dollars, when they're spent in the construction industry, that they're spent in a responsible way and that they're not going low bids. We have a low bid system. Public employers are required generally to take the low bid on a project. And
which is a way to save taxpayer dollars, of course.
Right. That's an efficient thing. Yes, that's for efficiency and to be responsible to the public. But absent some sort of floor, which we call the prevailing wage, then we're going to be sort of a race to the bottom, and people will be cutting contracts, will be cutting their costs on the labor end of things to get to the low bid. So there's got to be some sort of a floor that guarantees that our tax dollars are also not going to be impoverishing people in our communities that are working on publicly funded projects.
So you've had some champions now, Dan Gardner, who's the head of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. That's the basically the labor department in Oregon that enforces all kinds of laws, civil rights laws, wage and hour laws, minimum wage, that kind of thing. They also look at the prevailing wage, and they intervened and said to the Portland Development Commission, you guys got to pay the prevailing wage. What was the reaction?
Well, the PDC does not really like to pay the prevailing wage in any case. In this particular case, the PDC filed a lawsuit against Boley, and they prevailed in that initial. It said this was not the Bureau of Labor and Industries and Dan Gardner are responsible for determining whether or not prevailing wage applies to particular projects. And in this case, the courts ruled against that decision in favor of the PDC.
So basically you've got one taxpayer-funded government entity suing another taxpayer-funded government entity in order to pay workers less.
That's exactly right. And the PDC specializes in these public-private partnerships where they're teaming up with developers and different folks around the community. And they think there's some sort of a gray area there where if they're only paying for part of a project and they're only investing a piece of a project, that there shouldn't be prevailed, you know, that project should not be paid at the prevailed rate. That's pretty much their mindset throughout. And we need to build in some accountability so that we can check that and tell them, no, that's not right. If there's public dollars invested in these projects, we want the workers in Portland to be taken care of.
Speaking of accountability, I want to expose a little bit of the mystery of Portland Development Commission. It was created by voters with, I think, a ballot measure in 1958. And the idea was that it was going to be insulated from the city council because, gosh, you don't want city council to be involved in, awarding hundreds of millions of dollars a year in deals with private developers. You've got to insulate it. So instead, it's basically run by a board of five directors that are appointed by the mayor when their terms expire. Or they resign, and those folks basically then hire the executive director who's supposed to be accountable for them. Now, I guess in the last couple of years, a number of things have come to light about misuse of funds, for example, where they might hire a consultant to recommend a salary increase, that kind of thing. It's beginning to look awfully funny, and it doesn't look like that there's very much information available to the public about how PDC spends its money and for who.
I think that's exactly right, and they've got a whole lot of money to spend. Unfortunately, there has not been enough accountability built into this system. The PDC commissioners and folks who are working at the top end in PDC do not seem real interested in providing that public information. And if we've got a lot of tax dollars out there, number one, highest importance is transparency and how those dollars are spent.
I get the sense that this is something that's actually a growing concern now at Portland City Council. For example, if you look at who's the mayor, Tom Potter is not seen as close to developers as Vera Katz was, let's be honest. Also, this is my own personal opinion, I just detect a different tone and tenor at a city council now than there was maybe a few years ago. You've got, a 3 or 4 or 5 out of 5 are somewhat sympathetic to this idea that workers ought to be paid, a living wage, that there's something of value to, the government supporting a middle class, comfortable lifestyle for people who are willing to work hard. Randy Leonard in particular is really angry at PDC and would like to, I think, bring PDC directly in under the Portland City Council's authority, just like any other development commission in most cities, actually. They're directly accountable to the City Council.
Well, that's one way to take care of this problem is to change the city charter and make a PDC a bureau of the city, just like any other bureau in the city, and then they'll be a responsible. A commissioner will be sent to that bureau, and they'll be responsible to that commissioner and the council at large. And I think you're right. We do have sort of a new makeup or tenor in city council right now. Rent Leonard has always been a champion of these issues. And I think a lot of those folks on that council do not want to see this turn into two Portlands, a wealthy center and then everybody else, the working poor on the outside. And we need to, we've seen that in other cities around the country. And I think those folks genuinely do not want to see that happen here in Portland. A great example of their work that they're doing. Commissioner Sam Adams sponsored a hearing that happened last Wednesday at the Portland City Council, about 45 minutes, a report from labor on construction conditions in Portland. We talked about the PDC and prevailing wage, but beyond that, we talked about other issues of concern for organized labor community and working families in Portland, safety on these construction jobs, health care for families, apprenticeship and training programs to build a workforce of the future, and hire in locally. And these were some of the things we brought to the city council. They heard that report, and everyone spoke in favor of defending those types of things here in Portland. So it's really exciting times here.
So it might be maybe a few months away from an actual resolution which have the force of law, but you're saying last Wednesday that they basically liked your agenda?
They did. And we need to take the next step here and make some real changes. Saying things is one thing, and doing them, putting them into law, changing the way the city actually does business and the way PDC does business, that's something else. So we're going to be working. We're actually involved in what we call as a best value committee. It's a concept of contracting, best value contracting. It includes all those things I was talking about, healthcare, apprenticeship, safety. And we're working with the city and trade unionists on this committee to try and formulate some sort of an ordinance resolution that we can bring forward and hopefully pass sometime later this summer.
And there may actually be couple minute or two here in this segment. I wanted to let listeners know that there may be an ace in the hole for you guys in that there was talk last Wednesday at this hearing. Bob Shiprock, who's the head of the Building Trades Federation at the state level, said that they're looking at possibly putting a local ballot measure on to ask the voters of Portland, do you want PDC to be accountable to the folks that you know? I mean, how many Portlanders can name members of the PDC board? But many, hopefully, could name their city commissioners. They know them. They elected them, that kind of thing. It's not indirect. It's direct. And that's the idea. And they're looking at possibly polling, see if there's support for that. And certainly maybe there probably would be support for an insistence that PDC not bid down labor. This is actually something I learned recently. But apparently in 1994, there was a statewide ballot measure that would have abolished this prevailing wage law we were talking about. Portlanders, more than anyone else in the state, voted that down, which I was interesting to know.
Yeah, not every the prevailing wage, there's federal law and then there's also state law, and not every state has that prevailing wage law. Fortunately, in Oregon, we do, and certainly there's some business interests that would like to repeal that today if they could.
In fact, George Bush suspended it for a while in the Gulf Zone disaster area.
Example of those rock-solid leadership of President Bush when he hit those people over the head after the disaster and suspended prevailing wage, which was poverty level to begin with. The rate down there is far too low, and they suspended that anyways.
Ben Nelson, it's been a pleasure to have you on tonight at Labor Radio. Last question, where do you go to get one of those $20 an hour jobs in your union?
Hey, come on down to the hall, man. Local 296, if you're into building construction, is at 4545 Northeast 102nd. And if you'd like to build some roads or bridges around town, you can head on down to Local 320, which is located at the corner of 122nd and Powell Southeast.
Great.
Come on down. We'd love to have you.
Ben, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
We now turn in the remaining time in our hour to the third segment of tonight's show. We're talking about a national mobilization, a demonstration around the country that's beginning this Thursday called National Justice for Janitors Day. We're joined in the studio now by Maggie Long, who is an organizer with Service Employees International Union Local 49. Basically, it's the property services division of the union, which basically is janitors and other kinds of folks. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
What would justice for janitors mean?
Well, Justice for Janitors, as most people are familiar with it, was really the name given to campaigns that started in Los Angeles more or less late 80s when they began to reorganize there in the commercial real estate areas. And I think Justice for Janitors campaign became sort of synonymous with the sort of campaigns we lead, which a lot of times happen in the street, involve a lot of people, involve a lot of demonstrations. And so June 15th historically was a day celebrating that and celebrating some of the victories that they were able to win in Los Angeles. More recently now, it has turned to Global Justice Day because as we've seen things change in our industry, as you mentioned, we now represent or are known as property services. So, and we represent in several cities security officers now and are looking at different areas of people who work within a property, anywhere from maintenance to landscaping to janitor. So
does June 15th commemorate something in particular that happened in Los Angeles?
June 15th in particular was commemorating an incident that happened there. There was a cleaning company, one of the more nasty ones, ISS, and there was several who were, during the demonstration there, who were beaten and who were arrested, and there's footage about it. And so it got a lot of international attention and sort of was basically the breaking point and sort of broke through that campaign down there. And so
it's sort of the Haymarket Square for the janitorial set.
I think that's fair, yes.
Which, of course, is a pretty obscure reference for our listeners, but for those of you who know, you got it. Anyway, so June 15th, now that's in Portland, is one of the cities you guys are going to have in your mobilization. Just I want to ask some more questions, but first,
sure.
Let's just get the information out. This Thursday, is it at noon?
Yes, it's this Thursday at noon at Terry Schrunk Plaza, which is on 3rd Avenue between Jefferson and Madison. And
Terry Schrunk, by the way, being, I think, a rather pro-union city councilman a number of years back before my time.
Yes, and we'll be there at noon, and we'll be there for about an hour. We're going to have some food and some speakers and just talking really about the victories that we've seen locally and nationally for our union over the last year. So
let's talk about that, particularly locally. How many members, how many janitors are union in the Portland area?
We have approximately about 2,500 janitors here in the Portland area.
And how much do they make?
It really depends. It can, starting wages are from around $8, and the top of our scale would be at about $10.35.
And how much do non-union janitors make?
The non-union janitors make typically minimum wage.
Which is in Oregon right now?
$7.50, right?
$7.50.
Sometimes a little bit over, but usually less than $8 and without raises for years and years and years.
So $8.50 or $10 an hour is still no riches, but let's get to the other part of it,
mm-hmm.
which is that they have benefits, better benefits than the non-union folks, at least at this point.
Absolutely. Our janitors, and specifically in the downtown area, have a vacation, 7 holidays a year, a pension. And I think one of the more amazing things for our workers is fully paid health insurance for our members. We're still trying and organizing so that we'll eventually be able to cover families. But for somebody who makes, you know, $8.50 an hour, to be able to go to the doctor and to get health care when you need it is really invaluable.
Well, that's what I'm thinking, too, is if you're making $8.50 an hour, you better have fully paid health care or you're
right.
not going to have it at all, because I don't see how you could afford it. You're not exactly saving any, or at least, you know, not how I could imagine.
Right, absolutely.
When you're down there demonstrating justice for janitors, what is it that you actually would like someone to do? Like, and I don't mean the public, but there's got to be maybe a building owner that you were hoping maybe, for example, might agree to use union contractors. Is that the crux of it?
Yes, absolutely. Here in the Portland market, ultimately, it's very competitive, the janitorial industry. And so there's a role that janitorial companies play. But ultimately, building owners are the folks in the equation with the money, in all honesty. And when it comes down to it, it's about those building owners taking a responsible role and saying that they're going to uphold community standards and agree to pay more, because eventually they will be paying a little bit more to have a quality, responsible contractor that's going to have lower turnover, that workers have health insurance. So we are pressuring, I guess that would be an accurate term, several building owners in downtown to sort of step up. And we're really not asking them to do anything more than any others. For the last about 2 years, we've been on a campaign working with a group of service master workers who clean properties owned by the Melvin Mark companies in downtown.
Melvin Mark. Now, why is that name familiar?
If you've been to any of our actions in the last 2 years, you've probably heard that name. It's a very successful real estate owner here in the Portland market and has several buildings.
Just to be clear, you guys are only organizing at this point one very small segment of janitors. It's the, as I understand, janitors who clean just the high-end office towers, right? Or is it called Class A?
Correct. Class A commercial real estate.
Okay, so there's a whole other world out there that you
yes.
aren't even prepared to touch at this point, which is, you know, the person that cleans some factory or maybe, you know, who knows what, the maids.
Correct.
Good God.
We have made we do represent workers who clean at several high-tech industries, at Intel, at some sites in Vancouver, Tektronix. So there's sort of that high-tech segment of the industry, too, that some of our contractors are doing very well in.
So if any of our listeners own Class A office buildings, I hope they will consider using a union firm. Which are some of the firms that you guys represent?
Some of our bigger contractors would be GCA Services, OneSource, ABM, Everclean, Summers Building Maintenance. Those are some of our bigger.
And then within that industry, I know I'm asking a few real specific questions, but I'm getting to something. What portion of the janitors are actually unionized at this point?
In downtown, we actually, this could get a little bit too much into detail, but we go by geographic zones underneath our contract. And in our downtown zone, we have just around 70% density.
No kidding.
So the
nice towers, not the old ones, but the nice towers, those are 70% cleaned by union folks?
Yes. We look at square footage. So anything over 75,000 K or square feet is really what we're looking at when we look at that number. And so it's about 70%.
In other words, the nice buildings.
The nice buildings,
yes.
Yeah.
There's a lot of beautiful old buildings there that I don't know.
Yes.
For what. Maybe there's some reason that they're not in the competition. It's just not as big. So, and for now, you're not going after them. But, you know, one of the things I remember looking at a few years ago when you guys signed your current labor agreement with this group of contractors, companies, is that it had an escalator clause, which is, I thought, a pretty ingenious idea. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I believe you're referring to we refer to it as a trigger clause in our contract, and that if we are able to organize above 70% of the market in Portland, it would trigger healthcare for our janitors' children in the downtown area. That's a very broad definition. There are more details when you get down to the nitty-gritty of it, but in theory, the idea was that once we were able to organize more and raise the density, it would trigger that health care.
And we're talking with Maggie Long, who's an organizer with the service employees, representing the janitors, basically, talking about this demonstration this Thursday. The idea, though, behind that trigger clause I thought was interesting. You don't want these union contractors to lose business because they can't compete with non-union mm-hmm. folks. And so your idea was, once you get to the point where the union really is the standard in town, then some real economic gains get made. Then their kids...
Yes.
Get to go to the doctor. You know, right now maybe they don't, unless, you know, their spouse works or who knows. You know, independently wealthy janitors, I don't see it happening. But that's really
the
hope that these folks must be having now for years.
Yes, and it's
how far are you away from achieving that?
It's difficult. We're just under 70%, so it would take several Class A commercial buildings to put us safely over that. But that's exactly what it was built around, was that it is such a competitive industry that it would be almost ludicrous, and that our responsible contractors would be at such a threat of losing accounts that it wouldn't work. And so that's why the trigger clause was built in.
Maggie Long, I want to thank you for joining us to talk about the demonstration again, folks, this noon this Thursday at Terry Schrank Plaza, which is across the street from the federal building where all those, high security stuff is protecting our public workers. Again, thanks for joining us. Actually, I do have one announcement I want to make, which is related to, janitors and custodians and SEIU, service employees, which, by the way, is also a supporter of this program, which is, tomorrow is the last day for you to apply to the Custodial Civil Service Board. Now, no one knows what that is, so I'll spend just 30 seconds explaining it. 4 years ago, the Portland Public Schools I think it was 3-2, to fire 330 custodians who'd been working there, you know, a decade or more, you know, knew the kids, et cetera, et cetera. They were making $15 to $20 an hour, and they replaced them with a contractor where they would be making $9 or $10 an hour. A lot of us thought that was a pretty rotten thing to do. Well, apparently it was illegal, too. The Oregon Supreme Court ruled in December that it violated a little-known law called the Civil Service Law of 1935 in Oregon, which says that these folks have to go through civil service tests and so forth and have some rights and can't just be all fired because it was, you know, it was meant to protect the kids. You wanted a criminal background check, all kinds of other things, and it was supposed to be done in a way with some fairness. So those folks are basically being expected to be reinstated sometime in the next few months. There's still a lot to determine in terms of how they're going to go back. But one thing that the union is asking is that they need sort of citizens of goodwill, for example, cable listeners, to volunteer without pay or gratitude on this civil service board, which would basically you can find out more about it by calling Portland Public Schools tomorrow or visit their website, pps.k12.or.us. Of course, that's about all the time I have tonight, but I just wanted to put the word out there again for that tomorrow, if you can check that out. Tomorrow's the deadline. I want to thank you for listening to Labor Radio tonight. I hope you'll tune in next week. We have host Kevin Card will be talking about actually there's a campaign called Sleep with the Right People. It's the day after Gay Pride Weekend, and Sleep With the Right People is a campaign by Unite Here, the hotel union, to appeal to LGBT community, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, if I'm not mistaken, to basically sleep in union hotels when they're traveling. And we'll be talking, actually, that'll be Kevin Carr, will be talking with Cleve Jones, who's the founder of the NAMES Project and the AIDS Memorial Quilt, about that campaign. Hope you'll join us again at 6 o'clock next week. And I'd like to thank our engineer, Lisa Lelfing, and our guests tonight, and you, the listener, for tuning in. Stay tuned for Time Sound, a program of soul music with host Kevin Berry.
The previous KABU program was made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Iron Workers, Shopman's Local 516, and the Pacific Northwest Iron Workers District Council, proudly fighting to preserve living wage jobs and resisting their outsourcing. Information at 503-257-4743. Also, SEIU Local 503, OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. This was Labor Radio.